Americans have been in space for half a century, but now researchers are noting problems in returning astronauts' eyes that could be blamed on prolonged weightlessness. Hello, welcome to A Closer Look. I'm Ellen Lockyer, and today we're speaking with Dr. Thomas Mader, an Anchorage ophthalmologist who is working with other NASA researchers to find out why some astronauts are affected while others are not. Tell me a little bit about your background with NASA. You were in the military, but when did they approach you, or how did that
well,
work?
Well, we had a, probably 20 years ago or so, we had I was working on an image analysis. It's like an early computer version of looking at the retina to follow vasculature and things like that, changes, and it changes in the optic nerve and that kind of thing. And they were interested in that type of technology. So along with some other docs, we started working with them on looking at the back of the eye of astronauts during head-down tilt and KC-135 flights, that kind of thing, too. KC-135 is the jet that flies in a parabola, and when you go to the top of the parabola, you experience weightlessness for maybe 20 to 30 seconds. And we did some studies with that device there, and then that led to more studies with looking at intraocular pressures. And, of course, as an ophthalmologist, I was interested in that, so we looked at that, both in head-down studies and the KC-135. And then later on, some of the older astronauts began to have problems with cataracts. So one of them had, as it turned out, had cataract surgery with intraocular lenses. We reported on that. Then more recently, we've reported refractive surgery in astronauts, too. Then in addition to that, we've been involved in these other studies that I'll tell you about here before long.
Well, getting back just briefly to these the fighter jets.
KC-135. It's kind of like a passenger jet, like maybe a 737, only instead of flying straight and level, it flies at a parabola where it maybe goes up for 10,000 feet, something like that, at a 45-degree angle roughly, and then it goes over to the top. And then when it's going over to the top, during that 20 or 30-second interval, you're actually weightless inside the plane, and you float around just as if you were in space. It's a fascinating feeling. I've done it. It tends to make you very sick. In fact, what a lot of people call that is the vomit comet, because you're almost guaranteed to get sick when you go up there, and I was no exception. Most of what I studied had to do with the effects of weightlessness, which, of course, they don't experience in high-performance jets. The only additional thing that I looked at in quite a bit of detail in the group I was with was the effects of refractive surgery on high-performance jets and pilots, that sort of thing, and intraocular lenses. And we watched those in the hypoxic sort of an environment, and we found people, for example, who had radiokeratotomy.
And that is?
Tended to have. Radiokeratotomy is a procedure that was done probably 20 years ago where there are little slits in the cornea that people made. But as it turns out, when they experienced hypoxia, when they went to high altitude for overnight, that kind of thing, they had a shift toward farsightedness in their eye, which could be really severe. In fact, if you read the book In the Thin Air, it described the effects on Beck Weathers, where he was exposed to a hypoxic environment on Mount Everest, and he almost died from that because he lost his vision. Yeah, hypoxia definitely has an effect on your eye and your cornea. Now, if it's an intact cornea, assuming you've never had corneal surgery, the cornea thickens, but nothing else happens. Your vision doesn't change. But if you've had incisions in your cornea, be it from a radiokeratotomy or a LASIK or whatever procedure you had, it changes your visual acuity on exposure to hypoxia.
Wow.
Now, that doesn't have much to do with weightlessness, but it's just an example of some of the other things that we've looked at along the way.
So why would weightlessness, though, impact? And I believe you're going to have to give me a lot of leeway here.
Unless you're used to reading about weightlessness, it's kind of a difficult thing to understand.
Basically, the bottom line here is the experience in space outside of Earth's what we call normal atmosphere impinges somehow on the fluid within your eyeball.
That's correct.
That was the layman's way of putting it. And why would that? If there's no weight, if there's no gravity, there's no air, there's no nothing, what happens?
Well, when you're exposed to a microgravity environment, weightlessness, if you will, a space environment for a period of months, there are a number of things that happen in your body. One is you tend to have demineralization of your bones. The other is you tend to have muscle atrophy. In other words, your muscles, instead of staying strong like your leg muscles, they tend to get weaker. In fact, if you've been in space for a year, you've probably seen the Russians who tried to get out of the capsule. They can't even hardly even walk. It's because of that kind of thing. You know, you have disuse atrophy, if you will.
And it would happen in as little as a year.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. It would happen probably in 6 months even, you know, even shorter period than that. Because you basically, you know, you take it for granted, but you walk around here and you're always pulled down by gravity. You're always fighting gravity. And part of that fight is in your muscles, and you're constantly having your muscles tense and so forth in order just to walk across the room. You get exercise, but in space you don't do that because there's no reason to walk. You're floating. Mm-hmm. So people tend to have atrophy of their muscles. Their muscles tend to shrink over time. And then in addition to that, they have a shift of body fluids. In other words, even if you're in space, or let's say you're in microgravity on the KC-135 like we talked about before, even during 20 seconds or 30 seconds of microgravity, there's a shift in fluid from your legs up into your face and your head and your eyes, and your venous pressure and your neck and your head tends to go up a little bit, and your intraocular pressure can go up. It can go up by 50% just in a period of 20 or 30 seconds. So it's sort of an interesting phenomenon, but it takes place very quickly. So that's the fast version. But then over time, over a period of months, this same fluid shift can lead to other changes, which I'll get into as we go.
It gets very little press. What did all of this do to the human body? And you don't hear too much about that.
No, you don't. In fact, you know, it brings me to the chronology of how we got started on this in the first place. And we didn't realize these changes were happening right off, neither did anybody else. But what happened was, you know, we did an interview, an exit interview of about 300 astronauts. Every time they came off the space shuttle or the ISS or what the International Space Station, when they came back to Houston, they filled out a questionnaire. And we found that over time that roughly 50% or so of those folks who'd been up there for, oh, like more than a few months, something like that, consistently complained of decreased vision at near. They couldn't focus. It's kind of like if you didn't have your bifocals on. You've probably experienced that. You know, if you don't have your reading glasses, you can't see up close when you're older. I'm 63. If I don't have my readers on, I can't see a thing. But they started having this kind of thing, even people who are younger than me. But it didn't occur right away. It occurred maybe when they were 6 weeks, 2 months, 3 months out into space, something like that. So immediately they had no visual change, but over time it changed. And it seemed like kind of an odd thing to me. And we talked about it, but we didn't really have a good idea of what was going on. So we started doing some basic studies of people, started doing some looking at the back of the eye before and after missions, taking photographs, that kind of thing. And in the meantime, we started giving astronauts space anticipation glasses. It might seem like kind of a silly thing, but prior to a launch, you'd give them plus reading glasses, the same kind you'd buy at Cars down the street. We have an optometrist there at NASA who's the guy who does all this stuff. His name's Bob Gibson. But he gave each one of these astronauts, particularly the older fellows, like the over 40 gang, these reading glasses. And at first, when they got into space, they didn't need them. But later on, after they'd been there for a couple months, about half the people started using them because they had to use them because they couldn't see up close. Some people, even at distance, had a problem where they had to look through thick glasses at distance to see the Earth and so forth out of the window. So these are the kind of things, the kind of problems that people began to have. But we didn't really have a feel for why this was happening. And then case one occurred. You've probably seen the case reports there. And this guy complained, as quite a number of people did, that he couldn't see up close either after a couple of months in space. And then he came back. We took some photos and looked at the back of his eye. And Dr. Gibson noted that he had something called choroidal folds. So that normally when I look at the back of somebody's eye, it's flat. But you have these choroidal folds which occur. And when you look at the back, instead of being flat, it's kind of corrugated. The back of the retina, it looks like it has a bump in it, like a bunch of bumps in it. And nobody knew quite what was going on there. We couldn't really figure out what was happening. Then in addition to that, he had some what are called cotton wool spots, where you have depth of parts of the little spots in the retina. And so we saw those things. And once again, we just didn't really have a clue what was going on, what would be causing that in the astronauts. But, you know, when we started looking at that, I mean the whole team, not just me, I'm just one member of the team there. You know, we began to look at trying to think about things that can cause that. And, of course, with the NASA people, they're kind of an obsessive, compulsive bunch of people and very meticulous. And so at that point, we started a step-by-step process to sort of look at the things that might be happening. So we started getting better photographs, better examinations, pre- and post-mission. We started getting magnetic resonance imaging of the brains, of people thinking, oh, maybe there's some change in the brain that's taking place. We looked at the optic nerve through the MRIs as well as the eye. And we also started getting OCTs, which are optical coherence tomography, where you look at the nerve fiber layer of the back of the eye as well as the optic nerve. So we set those things in place so that we had the tools to evaluate what was happening. And then we started really looking at things very, very closely, which we really hadn't done in the past. And then we got another case that came in, case two and case three, and they both complained once again of the near visual changes, but they had disc edema when they came home after they'd been in space for about 6 months or so. And by that, I mean that they're normally, when you look at the back of the eye, if you look at it, it's flat. Where the optic nerve comes in, it's still flat. It's kind of like a disc-shaped area that's flat. It's kind of a homogeneous-looking area. But these astronauts, when we looked at them post-mission, instead of the optic nerve being flat, it sort of popped up toward you. It was elevated, which is a really strange thing to see in an astronaut, at least we thought so. So, in fact, that's outlined in the paper. There are some photos of that. And these were strange changes. It's the kind of thing, if I saw you today in my clinic across the street here, and I saw those changes in you, I'd be very alarmed. I'd probably get an emergency CAT scan or an MRI to see what was going on. I think maybe you had some sort of a brain mass or something. So there was a serious thing. It's not a small thing. It's not the kind of thing one would expect in an astronaut. So at that point, we really became concerned about what was happening. And we started looking at other changes. We found that the OCT that we've been done documented once again their nerve fiber layer thickening, which we kind of expected with that. And on these two people, we did spinal taps, which obviously they weren't real wild about having, but it was an appropriate thing to do clinically. And we found out their spinal, their opening pressures were mildly elevated. It wasn't bad. So that kind of went away, and we started looking at more astronauts. Then the fourth case came along, and this was another healthy guy. He'd been up there maybe a few months, and he noticed the visual changes up close, just like the others had. But about 5 months into the mission, when he had these complaints, as it turns out, we had a space shuttle that was going up to the International Space Station where he was. And we put a camera on board, a video camera, where you can look at the back of the eye. And we took it up to him and taught the people in the ISS how to use it. And they started taking pictures of the back of his eye. And they documented for the first time in space history that he had disc edema while flying in space. In other words, his optic nerve was actually swollen. And it's well documented in the paper. There's a picture of it that was taken in the ISS. And it was a very, very unique finding. And once again, we were concerned about it because it's the kind of thing that's not a small thing. It's something that it's a significant clinical finding.
Are these impairments in their vision,
yeah,
is that reversible? Does it go away after a while?
Well, interestingly enough, the disc edema seems to go away over time. Sure, some of these people we haven't followed enough to tell for sure, but it seems to go away, at least largely go away. The funny thing is some of the visual changes stay. In other words, they get that sort of a shift toward farsightedness. And for some people, if you look at them a year later, they still have it, which is a really bizarre thing. But we've documented that by cycloplegic refraction. And this fourth guy, when we finally got him back, the fellow we'd done the video camera thing on in space, we did a spinal tap on him. This was probably 2 months after he came back. And his pressures were high. They're up around 28 or so, something like that, which is a slightly elevated pressure. And that was 2 months after he came back. So it tipped us off that maybe these astronauts had a rise in intracranial pressure during the time they were in space. it would appear that whatever this is, whatever's causing this, and I'll talk about the possible mechanisms in a moment, it takes time. You don't have it initially. In other words, you wouldn't have this kind of change in that KC-135 I was telling you about, the vomit comet. It takes months. It looks like, you know, it takes. There's probably a spectrum of, you know, how people react to space, but it would appear for most people about 2 months out is when they start having these changes, where they have this swelling of the optic nerve and so forth.
And it wasn't everybody. It wasn't just everybody.
It's just some people, which makes you think that there's some physiologic change, or that makes people more apt to have this sort of change happen. In other words, there's something in their brain or their optic nerve or their eye which predisposes them to have this sort of thing happening. Otherwise, it would happen in everybody.
That's fascinating.
It is. Now, the question is, that pops into your mind, you're going to ask is, well, what makes one person get it and another person not get it? Well, I don't know. And that's what we're trying to figure out right now. But then we had three more cases where people came back and they had this same thing. They had disc edema. They had nerve fiber layer thickening. And we documented at this point that they're having globe flattening. Once again, this is kind of bizarre because normally your eye, your globe, is round or, you know, basically round. But in these astronauts, it was the back of the eye was becoming flat.
Funny, that's it. It's from the inside.
From the inside out. In other words, I can show you on this diagram, and I can, maybe we can explain as we go so
sure.
It's obvious to the people who are listening. You have a normal eye, which is round. That eye is not round.
No.
This is an MRI
like
we're looking at.
Looks like a volcano crater.
That's right.
Building.
If you look at this, this is an eye which should be round. The front part, I can see the lens and so forth. This looks okay. The back should be spherical, but it's not. There's something pushing on it that's flattening the back of the eye. Mm. It makes the eye shorter, which at least could explain the fact that these people are having a shift towards farsightedness. The shorter the eye, the more farsighted you get. So perhaps this is the cause of that.
But is that not age related? Isn't that what happens when older people cannot
older people
get farsighted? I'm farsighted.
You know, most of us are. As you get older, you become farsighted, but it has to do with the lens changes and not the shape of the eye. The shape of the eye stays the same in an older person. But with these astronauts, it wasn't a lens change, it wasn't a lenticular change causing this. It was actually a change in the shape of the eye. Which is an extremely bizarre thing. Now, the other thing is, if you look at the same diagram, normally one would expect the optic nerve, you could see it going into the back of the eye. It should kind of come back just like a pencil going into the back of the eye with no swelling there at all. It should be rather narrow. Here you can see it's swollen.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of pooched out like a big ball. That's abnormal too. So you have a swollen optic nerve sheath. So one would think that perhaps this swollen optic nerve sheath has pressure that's literally pushing against the back of the eye to flatten it. So maybe there's something behind the eye that's pushing the eye forward. And that would explain the flatness of the back of the eye as well as the shift toward farsightedness. But those are just guesses. We don't really know that for sure.
Of the several men, they're all men, I assume.
They've all been men, that's correct.
That you examined, was it something they could seek medical treatment for here on Earth?
Well, you know, that was debated, whether to treat them on Earth. And it is kind of strange talking about somebody being in space versus Earth. You're not used to doing that, but that's how you do it. You know, when they returned to Earth and we noticed these changes, we were kind of alarmed by it. I mean, not to the point of being panicky, but it's something, like I say, we were concerned about. Not just me, but the whole team that was looking at it. I'm just a small part of this. The question is, what do you do about it? Like I was telling you earlier, if you came to me and you came into my surgery office and I noted that you had disc edema and choroidal folds and those kinds of things, I'd be pretty concerned about that. I'd get an MRI right away and see what was going on. I'd probably even do a spinal tap on you. And if we did that and you had a high pressure, you know, that maybe there's some sort of treatment that would be involved in that, too. Maybe you had a tumor in your brain or something. But these people didn't have anything like that. Unless we couldn't really find anything to treat.
Plus, these guys, my assumption is they are checked out every iota of their
health is documented
before they go up.
Oh, yeah. These guys have been checked out by a flight surgeon ad nauseum. They're very physically fit. every single one of them. And they're the type of people that you would not predict to have any physical problems whatsoever. So it tells you, you have these people who are perfectly healthy people, healthy, young, athletic people who go into space and these changes take place. This is really odd. It's not the kind of thing one would expect. It's a bizarre thing to happen.
And does that maybe presage the fact that there's some bizarre things happening in other bodily organs
it
that
could
we
well
haven't
be.
Figured yet?
It could well
That's
be.
That's scary.
But it's the kind of thing that it's just a, you know, as a researcher and a physician looking at this, it's just fascinating to me that this is happening. And because it's not apparent to me precisely why it's happening. I can come up with some theories and I could go over that with you in just a moment. But
sure.
The reality is that I'm not sure what's going on, and neither is anybody else at NASA. We've had a bunch of other consultants, not just me. There's plenty of guys from various universities and so forth who've had input into this. And I'm not sure that they have any idea exactly what's going on any more than I do. But we're really giving it a shot, and we're continuing to watch these people very closely. And obviously people are still flying in space, and any American or from the European Space Agency who flies in space, we're watching them very closely with these types of tests I was telling you about. But as far as what's responsible for this, I think ultimately the thing that's responsible is a fluid shift I told you about earlier. You know, it's about maybe a liter and a half fluid shift from the legs and the lower torso up toward the head, and it raises the venous pressure. So it might be this rise in venous pressure can lead to a rise in intracranial pressure. In other words, the fluid that kind of bathes the brain, it can have the pressure in that fluid can go up. Just because of the fact when you have that fluid shift, it raises the venous pressure in the neck and the head. And normally there's a gradient from the cerebral spinal fluid pressure into the venous system, so it kind of drains that way. It's kind of a normal thing. But if the pressure is chronically elevated in the venous system, perhaps the pressure around the brain is chronically elevated too. So those are one of the theories that perhaps there's a rise in that intracranial pressure that is somehow transmitted down the optic nerve to the eye, and it pushes against the back of the eye like I showed you in the diagram.
So that would be, tell me if I'm being sort of too elemental here, sort of like when you're in an airplane, your fluid goes into your feet. I mean,
yep.
Your legs and your feet swell.
That's right.
This would be sort of the opposite.
It's exactly the opposite. In fact, there's probably even more of a shift than that in the opposite direction. And when you, even when you go in the KC-135 for 30 seconds, you could feel, if you think about it, there's a slight fullness in your face as you experience that even for 30 seconds. And if you look at the photos of astronauts, before the mission and during the mission, even after they've been up there a week or, you know, a few days, there's a definite swelling that takes place in their face. And if you measure the cross-sectional area of the veins in the neck, it tends to go up too. So there's definitely a fluid shift into the venous system.
Other theories? You mentioned there's more
other
than
theories. It could be, well, first off, these are just theories. We don't know really what's going on. The problem with you think about, that seems pretty logical, the first theory is a rise in intracranial pressure. The trouble is if we go back to somebody on Earth who has a rise in intracranial pressure for whatever reason, almost invariably there's a headache associated with it or some form of pain, or there's a nerve palsy, or there's swishing in the ears, there's something that goes along with it as a symptom. But these astronauts don't have any symptoms. They don't have any headaches. They don't have any other findings, which is strange. It doesn't all fit. In other words, that theory sounds good, and it's the one that I first believed in. But as I look at the symptoms of these people, it doesn't really fit what's going on. I'm just not sure that's exactly explains everything. So moving on to theory two, it could be that for some reason in the optic nerve sheath behind the eye, as the optic nerve goes from the brain to the eye, there's a rise in pressure in that sheath. That sheath is kind of a dead-end cul-de-sac, if you will. It goes from the brain to the eye. There's fluid that goes in then that flows back out, and it goes from the brain toward the optic nerve to the eye and then back again. It's kind of a dead-end cul-de-sac kind of thing. And perhaps for some reason with the fluid shift, there's a rise in pressure there just locally, and it pushes against the eye. That's a theory I really don't know. So it could be that it's a local phenomenon like that. Now, the other thing, the third theory is possibly there could be a decrease in intraocular pressure. In other words, the pressure in the eye for some reason in space decreases. Now you think, well, that's pretty easy to find that out when I just measure the pressure in space. Well, we've tried that. The problem with it is that most devices that measure intraocular pressure, like if you go to your ophthalmologist or your optometrist and he measures your pressure, most of those are gravity dependent. So if you take them into space, they don't work. And the calibration for a lot of the automated devices, like the Tonopen and things like that, it's all dependent upon gravity. So getting something that works to take pressures in space sometimes can be very difficult to do. It seems simple, but it's just not.
Is that the last of your theories?
The low intraocular pressure, you might ask, well, what's that have to do with anything? Well, if you had a very low intraocular pressure, and I looked at the back of your eye, you get these same changes. In other words, if I stabbed you in the eye with a knife and your pressure dropped to zero or dropped very low, and I looked at your eye the next day, you'd have these same choroidal folds that I described in the astronauts. You'd have the same disc edema. You'd have these same sorts of changes we talked about. So because of the clinical fit, we can't rule that out until we've taken more pressures, until we've taken pressures intracranial, in space. And then perhaps as a fourth thing, perhaps it's the ratio of intracranial pressure to intraocular pressure or something that we just haven't thought of. But those are the basic theories, and I quite honestly don't know which one is true, or perhaps it's a combination of all four.
Wow. What is the practical application of this? And I'm sure there's going to be many, because you know you go to the movies and they put the people into some kind of hibernation and they
sure.
sleep their way, you know, how many light years to get to wherever they're
yep.
going. But now we know that if that happened, maybe some of these people would get there blind.
That's possible.
That's scary.
Now, obviously, you know, people have been flying in space for 50 years and nobody's gone blind yet. But when somebody has disc edema, it's something you have to be concerned about. You just can't get that out of your mind. You got to be thinking about that and trying to figure out what the mechanism is, because like you say, potentially a person could lose part of their vision from that. They could lose peripheral vision with chronic disc edema. It's something that happens clinically, and there's no reason why it couldn't happen in an astronaut. So, yeah, that's something to be concerned about. There's no question about it. And the problem is, like you say, if you're talking about a Mars mission, to go there, I think, takes, 8 or 9 months, something like that. That's a long time to be in space in microgravity. So, sure, it's something you have to be very concerned about. The thing we're looking at is, could it be that there are some astronauts out there who are very predisposed to this and others who aren't? And it's a question of sorting all that out. And I'm not exactly sure how to do it. But right now, like I say, we're trying to do the studies on anybody goes into space to try and get more clues as to what's going on.
You know, they were already talking about bringing tourists into space.
That's
There's
right.
whole companies now that are experimenting with that.
That's correct. Absolutely.
Something your space traveler might want to think about before.
It is. Now, most of those, if you're talking about, some of the ones that are flying, I think it's from New Mexico or something, they're only going to be up there in microgravity for a few minutes anyway. So it probably wouldn't have any major effect on their brain or their eye or their optic nerve. But others, if they actually plan on bringing them to a space station and leaving them there for a few months, that's a different story. And those people, no matter who they are, or no matter how much money they have, you know, they're going to have to be careful that they're not subject to these same sorts of changes.
Would there be any knowledge you can glean from this report
Very definitely.
That might put into just regular stuff?
You know, I think any time you come across a finding that's unexpected, it makes you think about what's going on. And if I really understood this perfectly, if anybody did, any neurologist or ophthalmologist or optometrist, they'd be able to explain to you in 5 minutes what was going on. But the thing is, I can't. I can't tell you that. So it tells me that I don't have the knowledge that's necessary to explain this. So there's more, we really need more information to get a more facts to base an opinion on. Because like you say, maybe this has potential for other disease states. Because certainly you have people who present with intracranial hypertension and things like that. And we're not exactly sure what causes it sometimes. And perhaps this is related to that. And maybe in studying this, we're going to find out something that's applicable to pathology here on Earth.
Dr. Thomas Mader. I'm Ellen Lockyer. A Closer Look is a production of KSKA Anchorage.